National Gallery podcast.
Hello, I'm Miranda Hinckley, and over the next 15 minutes, I'll be bringing you news from the National Gallery, London. Coming up, are overweight holidaymakers the stuff of great art?
We looked at it for some time, not knowing whether or not it was actually going to come alive.
Lifelike. I wondered whether he was going to be sort of a miming model, suddenly going to move and make us jump.
Well, my belly's getting more like his every day.
It was really very lifelike.
It's really realistic, so it's a bit scary.
It just makes it extraordinary, doesn't it? Having something, you know, so normal just sat there. Wouldn't normally look at someone like that, but it makes you think about it.
Visitors reacting to Dwayne Hanson's lifelike sculpture of a sunburnt tourist. It's on show as part of Work, Rest and Play, a touring exhibition devoted to our changing patterns of work and leisure. And we announced the winner of our Sound of Inspiration competition. We start, though, with Renoir. The newly opened exhibition, Renoir Landscapes, sponsored by Ernst & Young, focuses on works he made in the first 25 years of his career. The pictures, visitors are discovering, are dazzling, full of life and daringly experimental. But why should this come as a surprise? Renoir, it seems, is an artist most of us are just a little bit prejudiced about. Leah Caribbean investigates.
At the beginning of the 20th century, Auguste Renoir was considered one of the great pioneers of modernism. Today, if you say the name Renoir, what's most likely to spring to mind is something possibly a bit pink, a bit fluffy, and a bit too sweet for comfort. Renoir is, unfairly, often dismissed as a bit of a lightweight, or not only by the public. Colin Bailey, chief curator of the Frick Collection in New York, is one of the co-curators of the new exhibition.
If you say to people you're working on Renoir, as I do quite a lot, they almost say, poor you, or why do you have to do that? Because he's not really thought of as a very serious, very cerebral, intelligent artist.
The current show intends to set the record straight, but why have we got this very particular view of the man and his art? Colin Bailey again.
It's his late career, the part that we're not looking at in this exhibition, that in a way does him more damage than any other part. It does him damage because of the large, pneumatic, Rubensian nudes that gain, in some ways, the disdain of both the historians of Impressionism and the historians of gender.
The current show, the very first to focus on Renoir's landscapes, really does give us an unexpected glimpse of the man and his work. Far from being an arch conservative, Renoir was an astonishingly experimental artist. In the galleries, I spoke to Christopher Riopel, co-curator of the exhibition, about this side of Renoir, and asked what visitors to the show should be looking out for.
I think the two things most important to look for and look at in these pictures are, one, his use of colour, these flashing, rich, unexpected colour combinations that set up a kind of dazzling quality to the surface of the pictures. The other thing is his sense of composition, which is remarkably radical and innovative. The way in which he breaks down our suppositions about what a composition ought to be goes off in different directions, flirts even with abstraction.
But it isn't just in painting that Renoir proves himself a radical. It's not well known, but he also had a wide range of intellectual interests. Colin Bailey.
He writes on art, he publishes dictionaries and grammars of art, he's well-read, he's a great friend of Degas and Mallarmé. Apollinaire writes some of his most enthusiastic early art criticism on Renoir. So we have a lot to discover.
Who would have thought, for example, that it would be Renoir who went to great lengths to meet the composer Wagner during his stay in Italy? In fact, contrary to all our expectations, Renoir was very open-minded and always eager to learn. He found working with other artists, such as Monet, especially invigorating. And in 1882, when he feared his Impressionist painting had reached a dead end, he sought out the reclusive Cézanne in the south of France. Chris Riopel.
In fact, he pretends he just ran into him, isn't that nice, and doesn't talk about what influence Cézanne may have had on him. And I think that there is a psychological dimension to this. He now had a dealer, Durand Ruel. He was earning money. He was in Paris. He was a Paris artist. Cézanne had no dealer, sold no pictures, and was way off in Provence where no one could see him. Renoir was now over 40 years of age, and I don't think he wanted Durand Ruel to see how willing he was still to, as it were, sit at the feet of a contemporary.
This story, like so many others, shows us how much we still yet to learn about Renoir. For both curators, Renoir landscapes fulfill something of a mission.
By focusing on the landscapes, which were always among his most experimental, most innovative paintings, I think we're taking part in a process, not us alone, others are coming to think the same way, to reinvestigate Renoir's role as an innovative artist at the forefront of modernist painting, and to show his importance.
That report compiled by Leah Caribbean. If you'd like to make up your own mind about the paintings, Renoir Landscapes runs throughout the month. Tickets can be purchased online at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Colin Bailey, Chris Riopelle and Leah herself all feature on the exhibition audio guide. You can hear a taster of their tour by downloading the bonus track that accompanies this month's podcast. Next up, listeners will be familiar with the National Gallery as a London-based venue. Many won't know that it also plays an active role in creating travelling exhibitions that tour the country. The latest is the result of a partnership with the Laing Art Gallery in Newcastle and Bristol's City Museum and Art Gallery. It traces 400 years of artists' attempts to capture how we work, rest and play, with exhibits ranging from Dwayne Hanson's tongue-in-cheek Traveller to early responses to the Industrial Revolution. I went to Bristol, the show's first port of call, to find out more. I'm joined now by Sheena Stoddard, who is the curator of the Bristol leg of the Work, Rest and Play exhibition. So if people want to come and see the show in Bristol, how long have they got?
They've got until the 15th of April, and we're open every day, 10 o'clock till 5 o'clock.
So standing in this room, these paintings span 400 years of the way artists have viewed work and leisure time, and this particular painting that we're standing in front of now, Joseph Wright of Derby, an iron forge, was painted in 1772, and there's a very sort of heroic quality to it, isn't there?
Yes, it's a marvellous picture which has been lent to us by the Tate Gallery, and it shows the ironmaster who's benefited already from the new machinery of the Industrial Revolution. He's standing proudly with his arms folded in front of something called a tilt hammer. This huge machine is being driven by a water wheel outside the building, and the light is all coming from this white hot ingot which is being forged in front of us. And the group on the left, the grandfather with the child, the supposition is that he was the smith, the forge owner before, and he used to have to do it by hand, by sheer manual hard work. And he's now slightly bemused, even frightened by this machinery. But it's a new age. So it is an idealised vision, really.
Looking across to the other side of the room now, there's a picture which was painted just exactly 100 years later.
That's right, 1870. And it's a charming, delightfully small picture by Claude Monet of his wife and a friend on the beach at Trouville in northern France.
So whereas the last painting we saw showed people hard at work, albeit enjoying themselves while they were doing it, this picture is one of complete leisure, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Seaside holidays became much more fashionable in the 19th century, and what had been a little fishing village in Trouville was now a Second Empire resort, big hotels and lots of fashionable people coming for their holidays. And Monet did actually paint several of these pictures on the beach itself, and we know this one was done on the beach because it's got sand in it. Just beneath the bar on the chair, that dark spot is where sand either blew on his painting or on his palette as he was painting.
Skipping forward almost 100 years more, there's a piece which is quite extraordinary, and all visitors to the gallery have sort of gone over and had a good look at it. It's almost the first thing you see as you come in. We're standing in front of a statue of a man who looks incredibly real.
Yes, this is by an American artist called Dwayne Hanson, made in the 1980s, and it's called The Traveller. We usually call it The American Tourist. He's in an airport somewhere, he's in a really jolly coloured shirt and pair of long shorts, and he's asleep on his luggage, on his cheap luggage. He's got a slightly protruding stomach, he's sunburnt, he's probably hungover. And it's how holidays can really be such hard work. You know, it's not all fun. We've all been trapped in airports and missed connections, or our flights have been cancelled. And you do wonder whether we have moved on or not. But it's absolutely perfect for this theme, isn't it? We've seen how the middle class from Paris enjoyed themselves in the 19th century, and this is what we call a holiday.
Sheena Stoddard of Bristol City Museum and Art Gallery. And finally, back in December, we invited you to create a piece of audio based on a picture in the National Gallery. Thanks to all those who took up the challenge, we've really enjoyed sifting through the entries. Our winner took as his starting point a work he first encountered in the 70s, Camille Pissarro's snowy London landscape, Fox Hill. A long-term devotee of outdoor painting, artist John Hall imagined the thoughts that might have run through Pissarro's head as he painted Fox Hill on a wintry day in 1870.
This must have been painted on a cold day.
It's freezing. My feet are absolutely frozen.
It would have been painted from life, on site by the artist, Camille Pissarro. He lived from 1830
to 1903. I wish those people would just go away. How long are they going to stay? If they stand there any longer, I'm just going to have to paint them in.
What's he doing? It's a very cold day to be out painting.
Pissarro and his friends took refuge in England from the Franco-Prussian War.
And they've got the best frocks on it. I think, I'm sure they saw me setting up my easel and they just decided to come out and...
We'll walk on the other side of the road. We'll say hello.
He stayed in Norwood in London until June of 1871. And while here, he painted several views of Norwood.
On the other hand, we could stay here and be included in the painting. Come hold my hand.
Chilly stuff. Knowing John Hall's penchant for outdoor painting, we invited him to try his hand at an updated version of Fox Hill. I visited him as he worked at his easel on the leafy South London street. We're standing on Fox Hill in Upper Norwood in roughly the same place where Pissarro must have completed his famous work in 1870. And John, you've been here since very, very early this morning with your easel painting. How's it going? How have people been reacting to you?
Very, very positively.
What was it about Pissarro's painting that you found so inspiring?
When I first saw it in the gallery, I reacted emotionally to it. I was a teenager, and I looked at the picture, and I read the little snippet next to it, which says he painted it from life. And I just thought, God, it's snowing. The image that came across was of a very cold scene. I've actually painted in blizzards where you can't see, like, 6 foot in front of you. But I thought of Pissarro standing here with maybe it's just two pairs of socks on and a pair of old boots and freezing.
And so looking at your sketches, John, you can see that the tree that was in fact, the same one that was in Pissarro's original picture
yes,
is still there?
Yes, yes. That's perhaps the most interesting part of this subject for me, the fact that that tree is still there. And it was just a tender young sort of sapling, perhaps about 15 years old when he painted it, and now it's at least 145 years old, and the ash cart hit it this morning and it's going to be knocked down very soon.
Landscape painting and painting from life is obviously very important to you, and in fact you entered into a contract recently to paint every day of the year, no matter what the weather, a sort of particular stretch of Durham coastline up near where you live. What is it about landscape painting and painting from life that appeals to you so much?
Well, I originally designed the contract to motivate myself to get out and paint from life every day, because I was just going out, preferably when it was sunny, and I thought, this is not on. I'll have to go out and suffer these extremes that the likes that Pissarro did here at Fox Hill in the snow.
And rather like Pissarro in that picture, you're not a fair-weather painter, so you come out in all kinds of weather conditions. How has that been, particularly when you were on the coast painting in often very exposed conditions?
It's been an amazing experience. During one blizzard, it felt as if I was on the front of a speedboat, because the wind and rain were coming horizontal. In fact, the rain was going up my nose, and I suffered for my picture, and then it blew out to sea, so I had to do another one. Other days, it was so hot the paint dried almost immediately. So I had to spray it. And then when it rained, I had to have the paintbrush in one hand and the blowtorch in the other hand and actually dry the paint as it was raining, kind of thing, because it would just wash off.
But not like today. Today's been fairly...
No, today's been...
Fairly good weather conditions.
It's been freezing, and I've got my all-in-one romper suit on, so it hasn't been too cold, but it is very cold when you're just standing still. So if anybody's thinking of going out, and I encourage you to do so, but be prepared for... Even you know, when you think it's warm, you will get cold.
Artist John Hall, braving the cold and the streets of South London in the name of art. That's almost it for this episode, but if you're planning a trip to the National Gallery in March, don't forget to visit our website first, www.nationalgallery.org.uk. It has details of all the month's events, including free gallery talks, family activities and guided tours. Join us again in April for news of the National Gallery's next big exhibition and to hear how Renoir Landscapes is inspiring gardeners and bringing the dazzling colours of the dahlia back into fashion. Until then, goodbye.